Endocrine Feedback Loop is now free. Anyone can listen to it on our website, www.endocrine.org, or by searching for Endocrine Feedback Loop on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by the Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello, and welcome again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 47th episode. Today, we return to the JCENM to look at a recent analysis of several clinical trials that hopes to determine if the effects of tirzepatide differ for Hispanic-Latino individuals. Reviewing this paper gives us the opportunity to discuss the findings of the tirzepatide RCTs at a high level, in addition to thinking about the benefit of studying the effects of medications in different subgroups within a population. Though this study utilizes data from a clinical trial, it is a post hoc assessment, so we will think carefully about the limitations that come with such an approach. I continue to be lucky enough to host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast and spend most of my time as a general endocrinologist at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, where I also serve as a medical director. Back again today as our regular contributor for this episode is Allison Myers from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the Montefiore Medical Center. She, too, works as a general endocrinologist and is also the associate chair for diversity, equity, and inclusion in their Department of Medicine. Her research focuses on diabetes technology and the disparities in care of individuals with diabetes, the latter being particularly relevant for our discussion today. Joining us today as our guest expert is Leonora Corsino from the Duke University School of Medicine, where she holds many important leadership positions. Importantly for us today, her clinical and research work focuses on diabetes and obesity with a special research emphasis on the complications and health disparities of diabetes in Hispanic Latino populations, with well-known work ranging from the basic sciences to clinical and educational programs. So, to state the readily apparent, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me today to review this article. As is also always the case, everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this episode, we look at tirzepatide in Hispanic Latino patients with type 2 diabetes, a subgroup analysis of the SURPASS program. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this article in February 2024. The first two authors of this paper were Juan Pablo Frias from Velocity Clinical Research and Rodolfo Galindo from the University of Miami. Now, Allison will take things over and walk us through the authors' introduction. She will point out the key points that the authors make, as well as getting Leonor to expand on several of them. Allison?
Thank you so much. I appreciate that taste, and I look forward to this fruitful discussion with Leonor. So the authors start off with something that's really important, and that is the fact that, unfortunately, Hispanic and Latino populations have not traditionally been well represented in studies. And it's surprising because the rates of diabetes in this community are much higher than you would find for white populations. And they reference the NHANES trial, which stands for the National Health and Nutrition Exam Study, where they try to get real-time population data to use this to get more information about diabetes, the prevalence and risk factors for diabetes. However, it must be noted that when you look at NHANES data, a lot of the data represents the Mexican American community, not the entire Hispanic Latino community, which is often the Caribbean, Central America, and South America as well. So even though they referenced it, we have to keep in mind that there are some limitations about using NHANES because there was an oversampling for the Mexican American population when you're looking at Hispanic groups. So one other study that we often will look at to reference a better idea of how our Hispanic populations encompassing all of these different groups would be the Hispanic SOUL study, which showed us the same thing, that you will see higher rates of diabetes in Hispanic Latino populations in a study by Gallo et al., which was in the Journal of Preventive Medicine in 2022. There was a prospective cohort of about 16,000 patients in which 10% were South American background and they had diabetes, 18.3% were Mexican, and the overall prevalence was about 16%. So I would like to ask Dr. Corsino if she could tell us a little bit more about, because she's been involved with this study.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chase. Thank you, Allison, for including me in this part of your podcast and this conversation. I'm really glad that you bring in the Hispanic community health studies or studies of Latinos to this conversation, because it's the largest epidemiologic study in the U.S. sponsored by the NIH. As you mentioned earlier, they actually recruited over 16,000 participants into the study. It actually provided very critical new information about how not all Hispanics or Latinos are created equal. And it's important to keep in mind that, as you mentioned, we represent many, many cultures, many, many countries, and very different genetic outlook or composition. And that is also important when we talk about diabetes type 2 and obesity in this segment of the population.
One of the other things that the author discussed was in terms of differences is that when you look at Hispanic Latino populations, there are differences in genetics, socioeconomic status, and cultural factors that do contribute to some of these increased rates of diabetes, as well as mortality from diabetes. So I was wondering, Leonor, if you could expand on how these three factors may come into play with our Hispanic Latino population.
Yes, I'm going to go back to the Hispanic community health studies or studies of Latinos, because in that study, we have a very good representation of individuals from Central America, South America, the Caribbean region, and Mexican Americans. And why that is important is because although we have a lot of research looking at the genetics of type 2 diabetes, it's important for our audience to recognize that a lot of those studies have been limited mostly to the Mexican American population, similar to what you mentioned with the NIH data. But we continue to learn more as we've saw there is actually a lot of individuals looking at the genetic difference between subgroups. So there are some genes that have been identified to increase the risk of type 2 diabetes in Mexican Americans and many, many more. But that's probably beyond the conversation we're having today. It could be a whole podcast about the genetic of type 2 diabetes in Hispanics and Latinos. Another thing that is important to consider that you mentioned is other factors that influence the high prevalence of type 2 diabetes in this population. And that includes the socioeconomical factors. We know that unfortunately, Hispanics and Latinos in the U.S. in particular have lower income. And actually, studies also using SOL data show that having an annual income less than $20,000 was associated with higher prevalence of diabetes when compared to those with an income of over $75,000 a year. Also, we know educational level has a big influence. Unfortunately, once again, Hispanic and Latino in the U.S. have lower educational attainment, with a lot of individuals having less than college degrees or college education. That also has been shown to increase the risk for type 2 diabetes. The other things that we all know, and I hope your audience know, is also the difficulties that Hispanic and Latino experience with healthcare access due to lack of insurance. And that comes from many reasons. Of course, the socioeconomic status, but also immigration status, depending on the states. As we know, lacking a legal status sometimes prevent individuals from having access to healthcare. And that subsequently has a huge impact on diabetes and so on. One other thing that is being a big subject of discussion is something we call acculturation stress. Some people call it a syndemic that unfortunately immigrants experience in this country, which come with significant stress level due to moving to a new place, having to deal with poverty, lack of works that provide the necessary income for survival and so on. And all of that are also associated with increase of type 2 diabetes. The last point I want to make about this is the cultural differences, which is also very important. And once again, the Hispanic Community Health Study and Study of Latino has shed a lot of light into how different we are culturally speaking. Also the influence of culture on diet. Although we are all grouped as a homogeneous group, our diets are completely different. Those from the Caribbean tend to have a diet that is higher in carbohydrate intake versus those in South America that is usually higher in protein. And that can also explain some of the data you mentioned earlier, how the discrepancy exists between prevalence of diabetes being over 80% in Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, and Dominicans versus those in Seoul that had a prevalence that was around 10%.
And I remember one of the other interesting things about the Hispanic Soul Study is that they showed that there was presence of African diaspora mixed in the Caribbean, which was contributing as well to some of these higher rates in the Caribbean-born Hispanics as opposed to what you find in South America. So I thought that's also an interesting Now, in terms of the actual goal of this study, not only are we trying to get more data about Hispanic Latino population, but we're specifically trying to assess the efficacy and safety of this particular drug in Hispanic and Latino patients and compare it to those who are non-Hispanic Latino as well. So what they did is they used data from multiple trials to come up with this. And I'll turn it over to Chase to talk more about the methods of the study.
Thank you, Allison and Leonore. I think we've got a very good understanding now of why we need data like this, what information we already have, but what we're lacking, and how this might fit into it. We'll do what we normally do here, is just think a little bit about study design and how this works in particular. And what I'll start with is, even though this is not in and of itself a clinical trial, I think it's helpful to remember why clinical trials are considered the gold standard in investigations. And I find it helpful to think about it in terms of what clinical trials do that observational studies have trouble doing. In this podcast, we actually usually look at observational studies. And in those, we're always thinking about two big issues, those of confounders and biases. And as a reminder, with confounders, the problem that you have there is you have an exposure of interest, and you're trying to understand if that exposure is driving an outcome. And confounders come to play is because those are separate exposures, but they are somehow connected to the exposure that you are studying. And for it to serve as a confounder, it is driving maybe majority or at least a significant part of the outcome that you're seeing. And in observational studies, if you can figure out a way to measure them, if you think about it and you measure it, then you can adjust for it. It can be dealt with, but you're not always able to do that. And with clinical trials, how they overcome that is randomization. And the way that they do that, if you do a study correctly and you randomize it well, then all of those confounders are going to be equally represented in all of your groups, whether it's two or more. So it's not that you get rid of confounders, but you balance them in those groups. And so to think about it informally, they cancel each other out. So that's the strength of randomized clinical trials, how they do that. The other issue that we have to think about is when biases show up. And to have a bias in an observational study is to know whether a subject has an exposure or not, is being treated or whatever else you're studying. And that could be something that the subjects themselves are doing. It could be something that the investigators are doing. Many times they are doing it unaware. It's not an intentional thing. But the key is that for you to have a bias, you have to know which group somebody is in. And clinical trials, the way that they overcome those, what gives it such a strength is that they can be blinded. The best ones are. And the best ones, everybody's blinded. It's the subjects are blinded, those who are collecting the data, those who are analyzing the data. And you can't treat somebody differently based on their group if you don't know what group that they're in. And so that's the real strength of RCTs when they're triple blinded in that way. Now, this is a post hoc analysis. So this is taking a group of RCTs. Allison mentioned it already, and we're going to look at those here in just a second. It's taking a group of RCTs, and then after the fact, going back to try to understand this question of, well, what's the impact within a certain subset of the subjects that were studied here? Post hoc analyses have a couple of things that we have to think about as well on top of that can complicate issues. One of the big ones is, it's a question that always comes up is well, if you're outcomes that you're looking for, if they were not pre-specified, then how did you decide that you were going to investigate these? And there's always a worry that, well, maybe people are just sorting through all the data that there is, just trying to find some positive result that they think will be exciting and get published. And perhaps if they're looking at dozens or maybe even hundreds of these, they just found one that by chance had a positive association. And so maybe it's a false positive result. Maybe it isn't really there and you just stumbled on it because you had so many that you were looking at. So that's always a question that we have to think about. And the other one, and this can show up even with pre-specified analyses, when they're subgroup analyses, is did you have enough power? The way RCTs are built is when you're trying to figure out how many subjects you need in that RCT, a big part of what you have to do is you have to decide what you anticipate the treatment effect being. That then helps you figure out how many subjects need to be in your study. And how that helps is for you to say that if at the end of a study we didn't see a difference between the two groups, you had to have enough subjects there that if there had been the difference that you anticipated, you would have been able to show it. And the challenge is with the subset, because it always contains fewer patients than are in the group overall, you usually will not have enough individuals there to be able to conclusively say that. So we always have to worry about that. If a study says there isn't a difference here, we have to say, yeah, but did you have enough subjects here to really be able to show that? So that's the power issue there. That's an overview of what we need to be thinking about here with clinical trials and particularly post-hoc analyses of them. What we'll do now is actually talk about these SURPASS trials. And it's probably a good place to mention here that this is an industry-sponsored report, and I do feel a bit like I'm giving a commercial, but the authors give an overview of the results of the SURPASS trials, and it shows that tirzepatide is beneficial in all of them. So I think it's a fair place to start, and I think it's a helpful place as a reminder, because there have been so many clinical trials, is to give a very brief overview of them. So these are just numbers. So it's SURPASS 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And the first one looked at tirzepatide as monotherapy and showed that it was better than placebo, both at lowering A1C and also driving weight loss. So SURPASS 2, what that did is that took tirzepatide as an add-on to metformin and then compared it to semaglutide, the 1 milligram dose, also as an add-on, and showed that similarly tirzepatide was better. SURPASS 3 looked at individuals who were on metformin plus or minus an SGLT2 inhibitor and then added either tirzepatide or insulin degludec on top of that, and again showed that tirzepatide was better. SURPASS 4, a bit similar. You could have at baseline multiple oral agents, but it was looking at adding on tirzepatide or insulin glargine, and again showed that tirzepatide was better there. And then finally, SURPASS 5 took individuals who at baseline were on insulin glargine plus or minus metformin and then looked as if an add-on of tirzepatide compared to a placebo add-on was better, again showing a benefit there. So just as a quick summary. So what the authors did here is they were trying to figure out which of these studies to include in this post hoc analysis. They chose to include the data from SURPASS 1 through 4. And the reason for that being that final study, SURPASS 5, only had 5% of enrollees who identified as Hispanic or Latino. However, it was much higher in those first four. So it was 43, 70, 29, and 48% respectively. One thing I think I'll mention it here because it fits really well is that in each of these five studies, that there was also randomization by country where it was conducted. So that's not going to be the same as randomizing based on ethnicity or race, but it's at least a step in that direction to try to make sure that those other factors are balanced there. So I think that was a helpful thing and gives you a little bit more confidence when these are added together in a post hoc fashion. So as a quick summary of what SURPASS 1 through 4 showed, is it showed that with tirzepatide that you had greater A1C improvements, and that ranged from a 0.6% improvement compared to semaglutide all the way up to over 2.1 when you were comparing it to placebo. It showed that you had greater weight loss, and depending upon the study, could be all the way up to nearly 14%. It showed that the GI side effects were very similar to semaglutide. And then finally, this group of studies showed that there was a similar incidence of cardiovascular events as compared to insulin. Now, an important thing that I want us to wrestle with here, the authors mentioned this, is they specify what they mean by the ethnic terminology of Hispanic Latino, and they define that as people from Cuba, Mexico, Puerto Rico, South and Central America, as well as other Spanish cultures. So, Leonor, we'd like you to help us here. So, give us a bit of an understanding. So, this difference between ethnic terms, racial classifications, the authors mentioned that. I think that we hear that a lot, and some of us are familiar with what that means, and maybe others of us are not quite as familiar with exactly that distinction. And so that's the first question, kind of how does that work? What exactly do we mean when we say that? And then also this component of then self-reporting that information. So that's a standard way that happens in biomedical research. So how do we need to think about that aspect of collecting that data?
I am so glad we're talking about this, and I was so happy to see that we are going to go deeper beyond the classification of race and ethnicity. And the reason I say that is because we know, and I hope your audience also recognize that race and ethnicity are social constructs, and they mean different things depending on the cultural and country context. So it is very important to recognize that the way we define race and the way we define ethnicity in the U.S. is very different than the way people perceive those terms outside the U.S. And why this is important is because for the trial that we are discussing today, a lot of those that were self-reported Hispanic and Latino actually were enrolled outside the U.S. So keep that in mind, that individuals in those countries might not clearly understand what we're talking about here. If we look at the pure definition of race, we know that race was defined mostly as a social construct and giving people a characteristics of how they look like and then grouping it in what we have race in the U.S., right? And then ethnicity is usually based on individuals that share some cultural background together. So that's important to say that. When it comes to this trial, which I think once again is critical, is the fact that individuals in countries outside the U.S. would not know what race they are or would not know what ethnicity to pick. And that actually comes with a significant challenge when you're trying to group people together, which is, I think, the authors of the paper try to acknowledge that a little bit in the paper, recognizing that that is a limitation of the information they're sharing. One thing I want to share with the audience is because this is so challenging, race and ethnicity for Hispanic and Latino, actually the Hispanic community health studies or studies of Latino that we mentioned earlier actually release a statement to those using their data to actually provide that guidance for people to be aware that because of this, they're not recommending that people use race as a variable in the data analysis because some members of the study or some participants couldn't answer that question. And I use the example of Dominicans. When you ask a Dominican what race they are, typically they will not pick black or white or others, they might not even answer because we don't talk about race in the DR as much as we talk in the US. So that actually obscures your data as well. So I hope I answer your question and provide the audience a little bit of an overview of why this can be very complicated when you enroll individuals from outside the US to self-identify Hispanic or Latino.
Yes, answered it very well and gave us just the insight that we needed there. Where the authors go next is describing their endpoints. So we'll go through those one at a time. So first of all, their main endpoints that they're looking at are mean changes from baseline in hemoglobin A1C, body weight, waist circumference, BMI, and lipids. A couple of those SURPASS trials looked at it at 40 weeks, and another two looked at it at 52 weeks. Another piece of information is the percentage of patients achieving hemoglobin A1Cs of less than 7, of less than 6.5, of less than 5.7, and then additionally, the percentage of patients achieving weight loss of 5% or greater, 10% or greater, or 15% or greater, again, at those either 40 or 52-week marks. And safety endpoints that were looked at were several treatment emergent adverse events, and that included hypoglycemia. And then finally, I think it would be helpful to point out that some of these endpoints were pre-specified, but some of these actually came out as part of this post hoc analysis, so a combination there. The investigators used a modified intention to treat approach here, and with that, all randomly assigned patients who received at least one dose of a study drug, including the on-treatment data prior to the use of rescue therapy, were included. The investigators used a logistic regression to calculate the effect of tirzepatide on the proportion of patients who achieved each of those hemoglobin A1Cs and that weight loss target at either of those 2 weeks, the 40 or the 52 mark that they were looking at. And then finally, a safety analysis was completed in the modified intention to treat group, including all those with baseline data who did not discontinue the study drug. That is an overview of the methodology here. Allison's going to pick back up and go through the results that the authors presented.
Thank you, Chase. So there were some differences between those who identified Hispanic Latino versus those who did not. And that would be in regards to their baseline age, sex, BMI, and weight. So in SURPASSES 2 through 4, not 1, people who were identified as Hispanic or Latino on average were 1 to 3 years younger. If you look at all of the SURPASS trials, you see that there was a slightly more females than males compared to the non-Hispanic white. And then also if we look at BMI, BMI was slightly lower, anywhere between 0.5 to 2 kgs on average for those who identified as Hispanic Latino. Keep in mind that in this study, you had to have a BMI of at least 23 to account for differences in BMI for Asian patients or 25. So on average, these people already were overweight in this population. So Leonor, any explanation for why we're seeing some of these differences in age, female gender predominance, and BMI with our Hispanic Latino population compared to those who weren't?
Yeah, I think the one that caught my eye the most was the BMI difference, because we know based on the data we already reviewed earlier that Hispanic and Latino tend to have more obesity than other subgroups in the U.S. But one thing that initially I was surprised by it, but then when I look at some of the supplemental data, I encourage the listeners to, when you look at the paper, look at supplemental table one from the paper, and you will see that they surpass 2 to 4. Most of their Hispanic and Latino are from Argentina. And we know that individuals from South America tend to have a lower BMI as compared to individuals from the Caribbean region or Mexican America. So putting all that into context, it's not surprising that actually those in those groups have a lower BMI.
Another thing that we see is that in both groups, they obviously received the study drug versus either placebo or comparator drug. But it was not a surprise that there were greater reductions, regardless if you had 5 milligrams, 10 milligrams, or 15 milligrams of tirzepatide compared to placebo, compared to metformin alone, or with SGLT2 inhibitor, or with insulin. So that was across the board. It didn't matter if you were Hispanic, Latino, or not. We did see that both groups, you had a greater reduction in A1C, as well as a greater reduction in weight. We also saw that because there was a difference in the baseline weight, that also contributed to differences in weight. So because people who were non-Hispanic Latino had a higher on average weight to start with, which was 102 kilos compared to 90 for Hispanic Latino population, there was a greater change in weight for that reason. So if you're starting from a higher point, you have more weight to lose. And then also was not surprising that when we actually compared tirzepatide to semaglutide, there was a greater reduction. Remember, semaglutide is only working on GLP-1, whereas tirzepatide is working on both GLP-1 and GIP. So working on the two hormones, you will see a greater reduction. The interesting thing, however, to keep in mind is the people that were in the semaglutide group were only on a 1 milligram. Whereas with our study drug, we actually had people who were on either 5, 10, or 15 milligrams, which could have also been an unfair comparison because ideally you would want to look at 0.5, 1, and 2. We also see that both groups had a comparable reduction in BMI and waist circumference. That's not surprising. If you're losing weight, you will drop your waist circumference and your BMI as well. We also see that with this weight loss, you see improvements in lipid measures. So we saw that the HDL did not go down. It actually went up. And we saw decreases in all the other lipid indices, including total cholesterol, VLDL, LDL, and triglycerides. And the nice thing about this study that we found is that there was no difference in adverse events, whether you're Hispanic Latino or non-Hispanic Latino. So we know that this class of drugs can cause a lot of GI upset, but we saw that there was no difference between either group. We also know that when used with some of the other medications, such as insulin or sulfonylureas, you can see hypoglycemia, but there was no difference between being Hispanic or non-Hispanic in terms of these particular. So those were the key discussion points. Now I'm going to transition back to Chase to talk about our discussion and conclusion.
So we'll start with where the authors start with a summary of their findings and comparison to data and limitations that they point out, and we'll wrestle with some of that as we go along. So the authors start out with a summary saying that tirzepatide was associated with clinically relevant reductions in A1C, body weight, waist circumference, BMI, and lipid levels in Hispanic Latino patients. And that the changes from baseline A1C and weight were generally not significantly different between Hispanic Latino and non-Hispanic Latino patients. And Allison pointed out already some of the explanations that the authors provide about why the limited differences that we're seeing were there. The authors, in comparing to other data that's out there, so they state that the findings in this study were consistent with the GLP-1 receptor agonist studies, and Allison's given us an overview already of the distinction here and why tirzepatide's different. The authors also point out that in addition to the difference of the medication here, Surpass 1 through 4 studies had far more Hispanic patients than those GLP-1 receptor agonist studies had included. The authors then move on to wrestle with some of their limitations here. And they point out some things that we were thinking about from the very beginning is that this was not designed or powered for a post hoc comparison. And they do point out that you have to be worried with post hoc analyses with these multiple comparisons. And I'll point out that you mostly get worried when you're finding some novel or unique finding here that you don't see in the rest of the study. You do then get worried, is this just because we're looking at so many different things that we find something? So since that's was not the case here. The authors found the results in this subgroup, the same thing that they found in the study population overall, that we have a little bit less worry about that driving anything here. The authors mention that small sample sizes prevented subgroup analyses for Black and Asian patients. We're going to come back to that in just a second. The authors mention that social determinants of health were not accounted for. We touched on this already, and I think that we'll come back to this here at the very end. And as Allison has already pointed out, a further limitation that the authors mention is that the comparisons with the semaglutide used only that 1 milligram dose and not the 2 milligram dose that is currently available. So, Leonore, we wanted you to help us out here a little bit. And are interesting. So the authors here point out they couldn't look at other minority groups. They just didn't have enough individuals. So they did have a lot of individuals, and as heterogeneous as it is, at least a minority group that they can take a look at, and they didn't find difference compared to the population overall, at least no major differences. So how does that affect us as we then think about, well, do we need to look at other groups? So the author specifically mentioned Black and Asian, and does a finding of no difference in this subgroup, does that make us more or less interested in looking at yet another group, or does it really not have an impact one way or the other? How would you help us think about what to do with that information?
That's a good question, and I think it's very controversial. I do not think personally that you should extrapolate the finding from a minority group to another. As we mentioned earlier, even within the Hispanic and Latino population, we are very heterogeneous, so I don't think it would be fair to say that the findings in Hispanic and Latino should be extrapolated to Blacks or Asian, in particular if we talk about Southeast Asian that also have a high prevalence of type 2 diabetes, mostly because of what we talked about earlier. If you really want to know if there are different response to drugs because of genetic factors or so on, then you should look at each group differently. That being said, I acknowledge that conducting clinical trials in every single different ethnic or racial group is very costly. So we also have to take that into consideration, that it will be asking for a lot of expenses. And we know the more we expense in developing the drugs, the more expensive the drugs are. So it actually makes the problem potentially a little bit worse if we are asking pharmaceutical companies to do trials, identifying how their drugs work in every single group. I don't know if Allison would like to add a little bit to that statement, but it will be very challenging.
Yeah, I was just going to say, as a provider in the Bronx, where a majority of our patients who identify as Hispanic Latino are going to represent Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Honduras, Venezuela, they're not represented in this study. So I agree with what Leonore just said. I don't know that I can extrapolate this data for my particular patient population. And I'm sure that other people in other parts of the country that don't have a large number of people from maybe Mexico or Argentina may feel the same way. Can they use this particular data to say this speaks for all Hispanic Latino patients? I don't think that's fair, because Hispanic Latino is not a monolithic group.
I think that's really helpful insight, particularly as we wrestle with, is we want data as granular as we can get it. But then, as Leonore just said, it gets more and more expensive. So how do you decide where that cutoff is as to, okay, this is granular enough, or no, it's not. We need to push further in. We need to get more specific, and it's worth that cost. So I think that's a really helpful overview as those of us who are reading these, not necessarily designing these studies, but as we think about that and how these investigators have to wrestle with those very real questions to try to give us that information that we need for the clinical care that we provide. And we'll wrap up here with the authors' conclusions, and where the authors, how they summarize their results. So that they say, in SURPASS 1 through 4 trials, improvements with tirzepatide were consistently seen in Hispanic, Latino, and non-Hispanic Latino patients with type 2 diabetes, and that this analysis provides clinically relevant information about the efficacy and safety of tirzepatide in the Hispanic Latino ethnic subgroup. So what we'll do initially here, I just want to think about the quality of this report overall. We'll think about how it might change or confirm our practice here in a second. But Allison, let's start with you. Just what are your thoughts as you reviewed this article and analyzed it with us? What are your thoughts on the quality of this report as a whole?
So I think a point that you brought up earlier is in the back of my head, I had to think about who sponsored it. So we always have to remember, when pharma sponsors things, we have to know that there might potentially be an element of bias in their publication. So I think that's something to think about. But what I can say is I appreciate what the authors were doing here, because again, this is a group that has a disproportionately high amount of diabetes, Hispanic Latinos, 19% of our population, but roughly anywhere between 16 and 20% can have diabetes. So it is important that they are enrolled in these studies. So I'm glad that the authors at least tried to gather some data. But really, it's when we're going forward and designing these trials and looking at prospective data, we need to be intentional about making sure we're enrolling all of these different racial and ethnic groups that have these higher rates of that.
Leonore, thoughts on the quality of this report overall?
Well, I think we already highlighted some of the major limitations of the report. I have to agree with Allison that I was happy to see that someone has taken the next step to actually do this type of analysis to provide additional evidence that we always complain that we don't have, especially in cardiovascular outcome trials. My hope, however, is that most of these studies would do a little bit better at recruiting Hispanic and Latinos in the U.S., because that will actually be critical for us practicing in the U.S. And also, one of my hopes is that representation for other minority groups will be higher. It's very sad to see that Asians and Blacks were not represented in a number that was enough for them to also look at this subgroup. So I think that was probably, for me, one of the major challenges there. I think overall, they try to address all the bias that comes with this type of work. So that was, to me, really good.
Also, for people who I have multiple identities, there are people who identify as Afro, Latino, Latina, and there are people who identify as Asian and Hispanic Latino. So they weren't really captured. They even said that they didn't even have enough data to look at that. So I think, you know, that also is important that we realize that there are these other groups within that weren't really accounted for. And it's not the fault of the authors. It all comes back to the study design.
So Allison, let's stay with you then. And you've mentioned already trying to apply this to the patients that you care for and how you think about this. So give us some more insight. Do you think these results, is this going to change what you do, confirm what you do, neither? Give us your thoughts on that.
Well, honestly, it all comes down to the insurance company. So if the insurance company is willing to cover these medications, I'm willing to try it on any one of my patients, because I think these particular medications have done so many wonderful things for people. The weight loss, being able to take people off of insulin, being able to take a medication once a week. I mean, I have some patients at this point that are on GLP-1 or GLP-GIP monotherapy. That's all they take. And their diabetes is well controlled. Their weight is doing well. So I just think that these medications can do so much for so many people that it didn't really make me think yay or nay. It just, I guess, more or less, like you said, supported what I'm already doing.
And Leonore, you get a harder follow-up question here. So similar about how this is going to change your practice, but go a little bit further for us. Allison mentioned insurance issues. The authors touched on the fact that this study, as is typical for clinical trials, didn't really delve into social determinants of health. Leonore, you yourself at the very beginning made reference to that. So help us understand that as we think about this, we've got a clinical trial saying that, hey, this medicine works in this minority population. But then we as clinicians, that's just the beginning. There's way more down the line, including insurance, that we have to wrestle with. So as you think about this, and you wrestle with this issue from a lot of different perspectives, but just give us your insight about how this might change your practice, but particularly as you wrestle with the different barriers that exist to actually getting it into the hands of your patients.
I'm going to start by saying that I don't think the results of this study are going to really change the way I practice, because I try to practice patient-centered diabetes care. When you talk about patient-centered diabetes care, there are so many other layers of factors that influence that. Once again, we talk about all the social drivers of care, and beyond what we already talk about insurance, there are many other things that influence how you make decisions of what drugs are the right drugs for your patients. That also includes issues with housing, access to food, ability to actually get transportation to make it to your visit. So I encourage all the listeners that this is great data. It proves that the medication works. But when you see a patient in your clinic, it's not about one medication or one person and how they match. It's like this person and all the things in their life that influence a chronic disease that they have to manage every day. That is not only what I tell my patients, insulin and sugar. There's so many, many, many things that actually impact the way someone can actually successfully live with diabetes and keep it under control.
And with that, I would like to thank Allison Myers and Leonore Corsino for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you by the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon. If you want to like and subscribe, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear your feedback on this episode or the podcast itself. Please email us at podcast@endocrine.org.
Endocrine Feedback Loop is a free service of the Endocrine Society. To learn more or to become a member, visit the Society's website at www.endocrine.org.